Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio. The Cambridge Film Show on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Cambridge Film Show, formerly Bums on Seats, broadcasting here on Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. But now it's time to lean back and enjoy the soothing opinions of our critics here in the studio on films big and small, in theatres and on streaming services. I'm Lorcan O'Neill, and your guides across the landscape of cinema today are Yazzie Osman.
Hello.
Mark Walsh.
Hello.
Emma Marchant.
Hi there.
Simon West.
Hello.
And Stuart Pask.
Hello.
We have a jam-packed episode for you all today. We'll be speaking with Matt Webb about the upcoming Cambridge Film Festival, starting this Thursday at the Arts Picture House. The films on the table today, we have Oscar-winning director Chloe Zhao's star-studded entry into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, The Eternals. We're following Edgar Wright on a dark trip down memory lane and Last Night in Soho. Kristen Stewart stars as the People's Princess as she haunts the background of a not-so-merry Christmas with the family. And if we have time, we'll walk a razor's edge with Tessa Thompson in Rebecca Hall's streaming release, Passing. So let's get stuck in and kick off with a cosmic story about people who live very long.
For years, we have watched and seen them accomplish wonders. But we have never interfered until now.
Eternals, the end of one era is the beginning of another.
Chloe Zhao follows up her Oscar-winning film Nomadland with this newest episode in the Marvel Cinematic Universe saga, Eternals. The millennia-spanning tale features a race of immortal beings sent to Earth to protect humanity from its ancient enemies, the Deviants, but sworn not to interfere in mankind's progress. Hundreds of years after the Deviants have been wiped out, a series of earthquakes forces the Eternals to reunite and question their very presence on the planet. Yazzie, the film features a cast so long the show would be over before I could finish listing them. How does Zhao fare in telling a compelling narrative around such a huge group of characters?
I think she does fairly well. I think Eternals is getting a lot of hate from some corners. It's not your standard Marvel film. It's a little bit different to what we're used to. However, I think there is a lot to be credited. I think the cast, actually, they do pretty well with what they have. I think some of them are underused. I've already mentioned to you off-air, Lorcan, who my favourites are, Barry Keoghan, have I said that right?
Yes.
And Lauren Ridloff, who I thought were criminally underused, actually, and Kumail Nanjiani as the comic relief. I think my main issue with Eternals is actually its positioning in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In lockdown, I was one of those people that watched every single Marvel film, which I thoroughly enjoyed, actually. I'm a Marvel convert. But I think Eternals felt a little bit more like a standalone film. And I'm not saying that because of the cinematography. I'm not saying that because of filmmaking. I'm saying that because they throw in a couple of references here and there to Thanos and the blip and all this stuff, but actually, it didn't feel credible to me that in the cinematic universe, none of the Avengers would have paid attention to any of the weird things happening. There were no cameos. It didn't quite work on that front for me. Other people, I'm looking, Emma, I can see Emma's face. They may disagree. I don't know. But that was my main issue with it. As a standalone film, I think it actually has some real strengths to it, as well as its flaws.
Okay. Stuart, the runtime for this film is significant at 157 minutes. Is there enough here to keep families glued to their seats for that amount of time?
Well, that's a good question. I think I'm a big Marvel fanboy. I always have been. Everyone who knows me knows this is a fact. And I usually quite happily sit through the Marvel films, whatever length you sort of throw at me. But I think there was bits of this that perhaps could have been left on the cutting room floor. We've had this conversation before on the show, perhaps last week, about how films are a bit too long at the moment. I don't think it needs to be as long as it was, but by the same token, it flowed nicely for me. I was quite happy to sit and watch it. And to the same extent, I sit and watch it all through the end credits so I can watch the post-trailer thing, so I can't really complain.
Speaking of the post-credits bit, there is certainly a good representation of teenage girls in my screening, who suddenly all came to life after the credits started rolling. Little did I know that this was due to the appearance of a certain character, or should I say a certain actor, that features in the post-credits scene. Emma, do you think that Marvel are relying a little too much on the zeitgeist for their kind of post-credits, or is it...
Oh, that is a good question. I think Marvel have done very well to keep this one quiet, to be honest, because I had no idea. I don't have teenage girls, I have teenage boys, so they weren't quite as excited. But it was an excellent reveal, as was the end post, you know, as was the end credit scene, proving that, you know, one of the many people in this film is going to have more to do. No, Yossi, I was not looking at you in any way to disagree. I'm with you. It is hard to really care about any of these characters when we are thrown with 12 brand new 7,000-year-old characters all into the screen in one go. They all seem to have the same kind of powers. They all just kind of shoot gold or make things with gold or fight with gold weapons. It's unfair to list people, but I think Angelina Jolie was woefully uncharismatic. Richard Madden just seems to stick in Dour Scotsman, I find, all the time. I just felt like I was watching him either as Rob Stark as a Dour Northerner or as the bodyguard as a Dour Scotsman. It's hard. Gemma Chan did an okay job as Cersei holding it together. I do appreciate the very the incredibly diverse cast they've got here. I think that is, you know, that was impressive. And Chloe Zhao has a beautiful eye, I think, for exteriors and for light and for natural settings, you know, because it was very pretty to look at, and not in the way that, say, Shang-Chi was pretty with vast amounts of dragon CGI, but pretty in a natural, earthbound way. But you just couldn't care, and this is my last point, because we all got things to say about this, I'm sure, but the thing that I've always loved about Marvel films is the script. The scripts are so punchy, and they can swap from emotion to humour to pathos in a heartbeat. And this was so clunky, because it required so much exposition, which you don't normally get in Marvel. It felt like there were paragraphs of exposition about, like you say, why these people who've been allegedly looking after us for 7,000 years had done absolutely nothing in the past. But you're right, I think it's come with so much hate. I went in expecting it to be awful and was really pleasantly surprised.
Can I just make a point about the post-credit scenes, if I may? I think in previous Marvel films, the post-credit scenes, they normally link to the next Marvel film. And that's really exciting. It gets you kind of amped up for whatever the next one is. I found with the two post-credit scenes we get in this film, they're leading to things we don't even know are coming. So when you talk about the zeitgeist, I do think it's just getting people excited about that and not really considering the actual cinematic journey. And I don't know, I had a little bit of an issue with that personally.
And you think maybe stunt casting as well a little bit, because we've used up everybody we can do in them.
I think for me, it's the way that we've transitioned from phases 1 to 3, which are in 2D, to phase 4, which is in 3D. Now you've got Disney Plus, you've got TV series going on, you've got movies going on. It's not a progression from one to the other anymore. It is, you have to absorb this as a culture. You have to know it intimately to get the most from it. It has to become a way of life. And that is a paradigm shift that not everyone is going to be on board with. People, I think, like the Bond films, you know, there was a continuing story through the Daniel Craig Bond films, but if you missed one, it didn't really matter that much. Now, everything is essential, and that in itself is a problem.
And Simon, are you excited for The Eternals 2 if it gets greenlit?
I must admit, when it said The Eternals will return, that's one of the times I did actually frown slightly. because for most of these characters, I didn't care about, and I wouldn't necessarily care if they came back or they just forgot it and said, it's a misstep, let's just ignore this film. However, there were other parts which did get me excited, and then one or two I would like to see again. I mean, taking on Mark's point, I think they did make a mistake here and make this a big film. This would have fit so much better as a TV miniseries. Sometimes it actually felt like a miniseries. You're sitting and binging in one long session. And as a series with more time, you could have spent more time getting to know the individual characters. I think Marvel have written the playbook perfectly on how to create a cinematic universe, which no one else has copied, through their phase 1 films and introducing new characters. And DC always faltered because they always tried to throw everyone in at once with the Justice League, where suddenly you got Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman all and Flash all in the same film with no backup and no individual films making you care about the character. And when you're trying to throw 10 new heroes in at once, I think Marvel stumbled, and that's what they noticed here.
I think we briefly touched on it, that Chloe Zhao, it was a bit of a mandate that there would be more kind of real locations in the film. Does those kind of naturalistic extra elements help the film stand out amongst the Marvel fare?
I think it's quite interesting in as much as you say that they're natural, but they take these places on Earth, but there's the historical perspective on them as well. So there is a lot of CGI on top of these beautiful landscapes. So, for example, one example is the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Obviously, they don't exist anymore. You can't just take a screenshot of them and say, oh, that's the Hanging Gardens. That's going to have to be CGI. So I think they do a good balance of making it blend between these fantastic landscapes and these nice sort of dusty, like American savannas or whatever you call them, and then just going to like a desert and then erecting a city in it with a computer. I think it's a healthy balance in this film. I don't think the CGI was too in your face.
I do still get a weird feeling whenever I see a location on film that I know I recognise and I may have actually been to, and watching them have a little fight in Camden is just slightly surreal. I got the feeling going through London a couple of weeks ago of this is the tube station steps where Jack Bauer came out in 24 when they came to London. You know, I still get that kind of feeling, and that's sort of weirdly exciting, but it is nice to go other places. I think it's weird, and please do correct me if anyone knows better on this, but I think that the order of events was that Chloe Zhao went to Kevin Feige and said, I'd love to be involved to make this film, after she'd made The Rider, and then because of all the delays she went away and made Nomadland, and he saw it and was like, wow, this is amazing, we should have more of these wonderful vistas in the film and all these incredible establishing shots. And it kind of pocketed Chloe Zhao, and I do really genuinely feel sorry for her, into this thing where actually that's what we're expecting from her. What she really brought to those films was a great understanding of natural character. And the biggest flaw with this is that none of these characters are natural. They all talk with this import like they've been around for 7,000 years. And it's not until Kamal Nanjiani turns up and starts that he's the first normal person in the film. I'll let you come in, Emma, very, very shortly. But contrast that with Shang-Chi. The scene around the dinner table at the beginning of Shang-Chi is one of the most natural scenes in Marvel movies, and for this to come straight after it is so jarring. Emma?
I know, I was just going to say, I think you're also leaving out Brian Tyree Henry as Fastos in terms of natural. I mean, he's the only one who gets given a backstory, who gets given a family life. He gets a bit like when you go back to Hawkeye's farm and you see Linda Cardellini there as Hawkeye's wife or whatever, you get to see his husband or his partner, you get to meet his children. And I thought he really stood out for me because I don't know Brian Tyree Henry. I think he's a stage actor mostly before this. I think apparently Amy and Tony winner. Do you know Yossi?
He's Paperboy in Atlanta, which is a brilliant series, if anyone's interested.
I am aware of your love for that. Yeah, I thought he really stood out for me as someone who's natural. But it's very hard, though, is it not? Like I say, to play a character who's meant to be 7,000 years. And I don't feel sorry for Chloe Zhao because I understand she wrote the screenplay and I didn't like the screenplay at all. So my sympathy is low.
Well, one last point on the screenplay. I was surprised by how much weight, sincere weight, is given to moral quandaries within the film. Does anyone feel like the film may have pushed the audience too far in terms of these kind of moral dilemmas?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit preachy and condescending at times. I thought it was sort of a little bit in your face. And I think that's one of the things that, for me, going back to how long the film was, perhaps should have been left on the cutting room floor. It's like, oh, yeah, humans are so flawed, boo-hoo. It's like, well, yeah, we know that. That's been established in every other film ever. But it's just, yeah.
Well, I think it's got this ambition to try and deal with these big films of the creation of the universe, and you know, should we, if there is such a thing as a god, as a sort of portrayed in this, should we be respectful to it, or should we be trying to make our own destiny? And it, I think in the end decides, yeah, let's just leave all these big themes over there. I don't really want to get involved in those. Let's have some more fighting with the shiny orange bolts, because that's what people really want. And it, you know, maybe Eternals 4 or 5 will actually get into some of these themes in an interesting way. But I'm not going to hold my breath.
I think it's one of the flaws was a lot of these issues and questions and quantities were obvious within the first 5-10 minutes. It's like, but if you set a world like this, what about this? And it kind of briefly touched on it and then ignored it. And I don't think it really did anything to tackle any of the issues in any meaningful way, which hopefully there will in more in future films.
Well, I imagine it will be easier to care more in Eternals 3 or 4, because if we go by the rate of this one, we started with 12, we finish this film with 9. So if we're going to lose like maybe 3 or 4 in every one, then we'll know who to care about by the end. Genius. Yeah.
As long as it's either Kamel Nanjiani or Barry Keoghan that we end up with, it's like musical Eternals chairs. It's one of the last ones to sit down. I'm good with that.
And Brian Tyree Henry. I've got to keep him in.
So a bit of a soft touch there from some of the opinions, but overall a rather mixed bag. Marvel's Eternals is Certificate 12A, and it's screening at the Light Cinema and View. We're going to take a quick break from reviewing to hear from Matt Webb, who's a trustee for the Cambridge Film Trust, to speak about the 40th Annual Cambridge Film Festival, which kicks off this Thursday, the 18th of November.
I'm here with Matthew Webb, who is Executive Director of Cambridge Film Trust, who of course run the Cambridge Film Festival. Starting on November 18th, this festival is packed with goodies, films, shorts for all kind of tastes. So Matthew, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm really excited to speak to you about the festival. Could you start by just telling us a little bit about your role, how you've got into the festival?
Yes, so I've been working with the Cambridge Film Trust since 2018. I came in as a trustee and saw the sort of amazing sort of work all of the sort of festival team have been doing and delivering over the years. I think more recently I helped deliver the Amplify online film festival that we had last year during lockdown. And I think this year, sort of helping put together the sort of 40th anniversary celebration.
You mentioned the Amplify Film Festival, which of course was in completely unprecedented circumstances last year. Going now to this special 40th anniversary event, how have you found it different in terms of programming? And what's that experience been like, given what we faced last year?
I think last year, I was quite keen that we kept going. I think it was important for us to have an event, and we supported many sort of amazing filmmakers. We put out sort of many sort of UK premieres online. And this year, I think we're very keen and very happy and enthusiastic to get back into venue. And so, of course, we had to make that decision earlier in the year when we didn't know what it was going to be like at this time of the year. And so making that decision sort of first quarter that we're going to be in venue, we will be fully in venue back at the Arts Picture House in the centre of town, but also working with two new venues as well in Howard Theatre and Jesus College. And at the same time, providing sort of a wider offer. So we have the in-venue screenings, but we also have the online programme as well that complements them.
Brilliant, thank you. For anyone that doesn't know, could you perhaps explain a little bit about what it takes to make a film festival, and particularly in programming? What's that like? What's a little bit about the process for people?
I think the process starts a sort of year in advance. It involves attending other film festivals. My journey for this festival started in Tallinn last year and looking at the various world premieres coming through there. So if you look at the programme this year, we have two films that were world premiered in Tallinn that I decided sort of 10 months ago to put into the programme. So we have Fear by Ivailo Kristov, and we also have When I'm Done Dying by Nisan Dak. And so these are two sort of brilliant films based on love and addressing sort of important issues as well. I think when you look into a new year, then you have a number of other film festivals and film markets. So we have the Berlinale, of course, and we also have Rotterdam and Gothenburg and Sundance as well. And I think Sundance has offered us lots of sort of amazing titles to choose from. And of course, those are sort of starting points for discussions with filmmakers and distributors and sales agents to see which films we could potentially show in Cambridge and how we start crafting a programme that we'll show in less than a week's time.
And what are your particular standouts? They don't just have to be films that you've created for the festival, anything on the programme that you really think is a highlight for our listeners?
I think that we can start with the opening and closing films. And so we're starting with a British film by Clara Bernard, Ali and Arva, starring Adil Akhtar and Claire Rushbrook. And people will be familiar with those stars already. But perhaps they'll know less that Claire Rushbrook is local to Cambridge as well and within a sort of taxi journey. And she will be here for the opening launch and there'll be a Q&A with her. When we look at the sort of the closing film, The Electrical Life of Louis Wayne, then that's also sort of a connection to Cambridge. And we have the director, Will Sharp, who was a Cambridge Knights alumnus. And so we have those sort of two bookends. And in the middle, we have this sort of extraordinary sort of world of other titles. And I have lots of sort of interesting ones that I've sort of followed through the year. I think particularly films like Memoria, for example, starring Tilda Swinton, Titan, of course, or Titan, yeah. By Julia de Cono. And it's a very sort of electric and sort of surprising film. And I think people will really enjoy that. We also have lots of other stars as well in the festival that people will recognise, such as Alicia Vikander, for example. And I think all of those titles are sort of big films that people will perhaps recognise, or they will see some of the directors that they know, but also stars that they know. But there are other films as well which are fantastic titles. And I think every title that we've put into the programme this year has to reach that sort of that bar of quality and storytelling and craft and enjoyment as well. So we're not aiming to create a difficult programme, but a more accessible, enjoyable programme. One of our programmers described Luzu by Alex Camilleri as a perfect film. So it dealt with important sort of topics as climate change and the environment and sort of even fishing quotas. But the main sort of character, sort of Jesmark, who is a real fisherman in real life, won the actor award for Sundance. And when he put it on his Instagram, and literally there was about six or seven people who clicked like, and it was, and one of them was his mother. And so all these little stories make the sort of interactions with the filmmakers and the actors and the directors quite special. And I think Lizzie as well, it takes you into that sort of underworld of sort of illicit swordfish trading. And it's an example of many titles we have that sort of deal with important issues and important threads, but they're also very entertaining. And at their core, they're sort of dramas and have sort of key sort of narratives. So.
I think one thing that I personally am always impressed by with the Cambridge Film Festival every year is the breadth of filmmaking and the real global feel to a lot of the programming. Would you mind just a comment or two on what that means for the festival and, you know, the kind of scope of films that you've got this year globally?
I think sort of depicting the festival as a world festival is really important to me. I spent sort of 12 years living abroad in China and Russia and Brazil. And I've seen so many filmmakers and stories presented in other places. And it's wonderful to be able to present that in Cambridge as well, especially when you consider the sort of demographics of Cambridge and people coming from all over the world. We've looked at about 3,000 films in total this year to narrow it down to just over 100. Out of just over 100, more than half of those are UK premieres. And so we're not only sort of looking to the world for sort of interesting stories and films and people, but we're also trying to bring something new as well. And I think the sort of the premieres status of so many of the titles that sort of speak to that. And also trying to make sure that different countries are represented as well. And so we have France and Belgium, we have Germany, we have Iran, we have China, we have Japan. Well, we have a whole season of Japan films with award winners from Cannes, for example, the Ryosuke Hamaguchi film Drive My Car, but also Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. We also have the Catalonia strand, the Camera Catalonia, which has this brilliant film, really funny film called Sentimental, or in English, The People Upstairs. And it's about this sort of two couples who sort of live side by side in an apartment block, and they're always sort of getting to the point where they're going to meet up and have dinner together, but it never happens. And it's really the story about what happens that evening when these two sort of groups of people to get together. And it's just been shortlisted for the European Film Awards in the comedy section. And I think when a lot of the films that were programmed for the festival, it's not clear the trajectory for many of them. And it's incredibly rewarding to see over time, over months, over years, that what happens to those films. And so already, since being programmed, more than eight are on the list of Oscar nominations, for example. We have like Great Freedom, for example, by Sebastian Mise, which is an important title, as well as Flee, for example, which is a great story about a man making a new life in Denmark after escaping Afghanistan. But at the same time, it's told in a very sort of new sort of genre-bending way. It's a documentary, but it's an animation, but it's, you've got the people within the frame rather than outside of the frame. And it's something exciting and interesting and important.
Thank you. And one final question from me, if I may. Some of our listeners, they may have families and young children who would be interested in coming to the festival. I know you mentioned your daughter, Lucia, helped with picking some of the films. Could you give any recommendation for some of the more family, children films that our listeners might be interested in seeing?
Yes, I can start with Pupa Love Chimney Town. And so Pupa Love Chimney Town is a Japanese animated film. And we have it in two versions. We have an English version, which is on Sunday, 21st of November at 10 a.m. We also have two other screenings in Japanese with English subtitles. And this is a film about a young character, Lubichi. And Lubichi lives in a world of chimneys and smoke and an environment which is a bit polluted, but also people who have closed minds. And he spends each day at the top of chimney stacks trying to sort of wonder if that's all there is, or if there's more to life or more to the world. And through sort of interacting with various sort of characters, he finds that really the smoke doesn't have to be there. I mean, the control doesn't have to be there. He sort of explodes the smoke away, both in people's minds and also literally in the environment. So that's definitely one title. We also have Petit Moment. And so people who will recognise, and everybody who comes to the festival will know, sort of Celine Sciamma. And we had Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Brilliant film.
Yes, brilliant film. All brilliant films that Sciamma's made. And yes, and it's good to have her back. And so we have two screenings of Petit Maman, and it centres around sort of two young children. One young girl who's, her grandmother has passed away, and she's coming to terms with that loss. But she finds that sort of solace and friendship with another girl who lives close to home. And it's a very sort of important story, I think, in general, but also at this time, and how we sort of deal with sort of difficult moments in our life, but also the joy from finding somebody, finding a friend, and what role that plays in our lives. It's fantastic also that the two girls, of course, are sisters in real life, and so it makes it even more authentic. We do have that thread of authenticity through all of this, whether it's the sort of fisherman in Lizu, or if it's a portrayal of a Holocaust survivor in I Am Here, which is also accessible to children, I think, as well. So I think there are really sort of important stories and messages. And I think guided by not only sort of the narratives, but also potentially some of the stories, such as Roaring Twenties, may be appropriate for sort of children who are getting into their teenage years. And it's a very positive story about people coming out of seclusion, people coming out of lockdown, and a sort of an optimistic time, I think, as well. So lots of things for, I don't like to say there's something for everybody, but I think there are films that will speak to different audiences and different tastes. And I think the one message I would like to get across is take a chance on some of the films, because these will be the only time that many of them will ever play in Cambridge, and they won't be coming back. So then we'll be watching them again on a small screen rather than on a big screen. So it's a very short window of time. So do take that.
And a massive thank you to Matt for taking the time to speak with us. The Cambridge Film Festival starts this Thursday, the 18th, and goes on until the 25th of November.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Weekends on Cambridge 105 Radio. Flavour explores the food scene in the city in South Cambridgeshire, speaking to the chefs who've made Cambridge their home.
I'm just very passionate about oysters. I love eating oysters. And yeah, I suppose it was something that I found that there was something to explore.
The food trucks, the market stall holders, and those delivering fresh food to your door.
It's that kohlrabi. We used to have to give it away because no one would touch it until they got to try it and use it, and then they came back and had it more.
Flavour, this Saturday at midday, online and on Cambridge 105 Radio.
just your average night. Fraser's upstairs gaming online with his mates. Sophie's streaming her favourite tunes in her bedroom. Mum's downloading the latest drama box set. And Dad's liking kitten videos on his phone. But this isn't your average night. Thanks to CityFibre's full fibre network, everyone's gaming, streaming and scrolling at breakneck speed. Join Cambridge's gigabit revolution today. Head to cityfibre.com/Cambridge105.
Would you like to work for a company that cares? Caremark Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire, a local family-run home care business, are looking for compassionate, caring people who'd enjoy delivering an exceptional care service within their clients' homes. Full training is given and you'd receive a competitive hourly rate of pay and benefits. This is a hugely rewarding role, looking after vulnerable people who require the help and support, which allows them to remain living in their own homes. If you'd like to know more about joining the Caremark team as a care and support worker, call 01223 778818 or email cambridge@caremark.co.uk.
Two classic decades, 1 hour, too good to be forgotten.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Now to tackle the next film on our slate. Edgar Wright is taking us back in time with Last Night in Soho, but it might not be the good time one can expect from swinging 60s London.
Baby, you don't know what you're saying.
What brings you down then?
I'm studying London College of Fashion.
Room is on the top floor.
It's perfect. I love it. If I could live any place and any time, I'd live here in London in the 60s. Something in my dreams. There was a girl.
Thomas and Mackenzie stars as Eloise, an aspiring fashion designer who is mysteriously whisked into the past through her dreams and sucked into the glamour of a bygone London where a dark history unfolds before her. And we're going to discuss the film without going into spoilers, as Edgar Wright himself has asked everyone to keep the secret secret for those experiencing the film as intended in cinemas. Simon, Edgar Wright broke into the international market with Shaun of the Dead, his only other foray into horror, albeit a satirical one. Is this a successful horror film?
It is a successful horror film. Obviously, he's been very influenced by George Romero in Shaun of the Dead and his earlier films before branching out into more comedy and more pop culture films, where he is constantly honing his craft, such as Scott Pilgrim and, of course, Baby Driver. Here, he's definitely paying homage to one of his other horror icons, or Dario Argento. It has a very, very strong giallo feel to it, a pure psychological horror rather than being straight out scary jump scare horror. It is very, very unsettling in places in time. But the breakout part of this film is really, again, the two amazing actresses in the central role, Anya Taylor-Joy and Thomasin McKenzie, playing the the two main leads, the nightclub singer and the fashion designer, who's gone to London to try and follow her dream and realise that a lot of her dreams can actually become nightmares. This, technically, it is an amazing film. It's got some of the most technical bravado works and scenes I've seen. The scene where Thomas McKenzie first goes into a nightclub, and you can see all the reflections in mirrors when Alan Taylor-Joy and the characters start merging, and you don't know which one's which, and constantly switching back and forth is some of the best filmmaking I've seen this year. Overall, I thought it was an absolutely wonderful film.
Yeah, as Edgar Wright is often known for his style, and this is certainly a stylish film. Mark, did you find this mystery film to be a satisfying mystery?
Not in the slightest, unfortunately.
Oh dear.
And it's a big disappointment for me, because I would actually get a T-shirt saying Edgar Wright fanboy, and I would wear it in public. I am that much of a fan. I have loved every one of his previous films, and I think apart from The World's End, I would, if I was giving marks out of 10, it would be double-digit scores for the majority of them. Maybe, in that case, expectations were too high. Maybe that's why I didn't quite chime with it. I would agree with Simon in that it is very giallo-influenced, this wonderful genre of 70s Italian horror with these wonderful lurid colours, and it fits so well with the 60s setting that he's trying to create. He also created a playlist for Spotify and Apple Music and lots of the other services with this incredible 60s soundtrack. He knows his music, he knows his films. On the evidence of this, he doesn't know how to write a script, and it's deeply disappointing.
Well, Emma, on following on from that, Edgar Wright's films are often synonymous with great soundtracks. Do you find that in this particular film, how is the music used for this new genre he's entering? And do you think it's ever a crutch for good story, engaging storytelling?
Oh, without doubt, it's a crutch for an engaging story and a half-decent screenplay. I'm with Mark on that one, as is also the glorious look of Anya Taylor-Joy. I mean, I don't know if anyone's been seeing the press she's been doing lately anyway, but if anybody kind of looks like... You could almost believe that they're going to do a range of Barbie dolls that she is currently sort of Anya Taylor-Joy that she's currently promoting. I mean, she looks... The styling is amazing. And also, I will shout out, I really enjoyed Matt Smith in this. And, of course, Terrence Stamp. And I like the fact, you know, I like the fact that he uses some of the most, you know, you've got Cilla Black and Petula Clark and all these incredibly bouncy 60s tracks set to an incredibly dark underbelly of, you know, CD Soho. But I feel we've seen that kind of thing before. We even saw it in, like, Our Friends in the North when Daniel Craig, in fact, again, with Terrence Stamp, when Daniel Craig and Terrence Stamp sort of, you know, he gets dragged into the CD underbelly of Soho. It just... I thought this was kind of feather light. I didn't see... I didn't know what to expect. I certainly didn't go in with high expectations. I don't mind Edgar Wright. For some reason, I've seemed to have seen Baby Driver about four times, and I quite enjoy it, but I don't really... I never thought it was like the second coming, like people tend to. Shaun of the Dead and The World's End have both left me cold. Cold, cold, cold. So when I saw her flicking through a vinyl at the beginning, I was like, oh, Edgar Wright and your vinyl, you're killing me. But it's... I don't know. It swept by and it kept me entertained, and I didn't see where the story was going, and I thought that was pretty clever. I liked the beats of it. I enjoyed that he's thrown in some classic 60s acts. It was great to see the late, great Diana Rigg in probably, I guess, her final role. So that was also, you know, it's a benefit, but none of this makes up for, yeah, a very slight script. I wasn't terribly overjoyed by the lead actress's performance either. I found them both slightly overly mannered, but meh. That's really... So I'm sitting somewhere in between these two, aren't I?
Yeah, I'm very much at the other end of the spectrum. And I think let's not diss too much on Edgar Wright, because we need to diss on Christy Wilson-Cairns as well. Because I love 1917, which she was also the scriptwriter for. And, you know, the hope would be that if she is coming in, it's going to be a more balanced female perspective. I cannot speak from a female perspective, but I didn't feel like the film had any idea what a female's perspective was either, which is slightly disturbing given that one of the two screenwriters is female. The whole film is trying to condemn the Soho of the 60s and the culture of the time and celebrate it at the same time. And these two things never fit together in any sense whatsoever. But the script itself is the thing I've got the biggest bugbear with. The characters are underdeveloped, they're tokenistic, they're clichés beyond belief, they don't really have anything beyond a facade. And maybe that's some kind of illusion for fashion or something like that. But even her fashion is not great. She goes in and draws one dress. And the fashion school surely would have gone, I'm sorry, you know, D minus, that's not good enough. Yes, it's not 21st century fashion.
I don't know, having recently seen In the Heights, Mark, where I was so appalled by the fashion designer at the end of that, I was quite pleasantly surprised by her fashions. But you're right as well in that even the modern day characters are really oddly written, like the her fellow students at the London College of Fashion, you know, hate her from the moment she turns up, and there's never really any reason given for that. But I guess this is part of the psychological horror of it, so...
Yeah. I mean, it does feel like a badly written children's drama, and it has to be badly written because most children's dramas I've seen are actually really well written. This would not stand up as an episode of Grange Hill with a bit of horror over it. I just really did not get on with it at all, in case you hadn't picked it up already.
So a wide range of opinions there, from Edgar Wright's best film to Edgar Wright's worst film. Last Night in Soho is a Certificate 18, and it's screening at Vue and the Arts Picture House. You're listening to the Cambridge Film Show. We have about 20 minutes left, and we'll be wrapping up this eclectic week with a double dose of female-driven character dramas, the first of which comes from the director of Jackie, Pablo Larraine. We're spending Christmas with the royals as seen through the eyes of Princess Diana in Spencer.
Is she here yet?
Not yet, ma'am, no.
Then she's late.
Yes, she is late.
Your Royal Highness.
Mummy, you.
Family are all gathered in the drawing room. They are waiting.
3 days. That's it.
They're getting quite serious about you.
So stand very still and smile a lot.
They know everything.
They don't. Do you want to be the queen?
I'll be your mum.
Here, in this house, there is no future. Past and the present are the same thing.
Diana,
they can't change.
The night of Peaky Blinders fame, Kristen Stewart stars as the Princess of Wales in this fictionalized but nonetheless researched interpretation of her life as a royal, as encapsulated by a harrowing weekend with the Queen's family over Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, watched over by the distinguished yet mysterious figure of Timothy Spall. Mark, there have been quite a few actresses to take up the role of Diana, including Naomi Watts and quite recently Emma Corrin in Peter Morgan's The Crown series. What does Kristen Stewart bring to this role?
I was a little concerned on seeing the trailer that she was going to bring broad caricature, and I'm relieved to say, having seen the film, that I thought she brought an awful lot more to it. I think works well as a film because it's not trying to be a complete biography. It's not trying to tell years and years worth of a story. It's focused in on the two-day period over the last Christmas she was a member of the royal family. And actually, I thought there was an awful lot of depth and a lot of good work in Kristen Stewart's performance, and I was really a fan of it. But I think it also helps that she's surrounded by such good actors who respond off her as well. The three main members of the waiting staff, you've got Sean Harris as the cook, you've got Sally Hawkins, who I just bow down to and worship, frankly. She's astonishing in everything. You've also got Timothy Spall as the Queen Mother's equerry who comes in to try and make sure that Diana is behaving herself. And Kristen Stewart's performance stands up against all of these fantastic British actors. And I was a big fan of this.
Excellent. I'll freely admit that I'm not an authority remotely on any royal family of any era. But Emma, would you say this is an objectively accurate summation of Diana's life?
Who knows? I was working and living in London. I was actually working for ITN News when Diana died. And I know that we're a mix of ages in this studio, but I would say that probably Stuart and York would be a little younger. I mean, it was like nothing we'd ever seen in this country when she died. And I don't think this film shows any of the charm that Diana had that made people fall in love with her. She comes across, and it's partly Christine, I'm not going to rag on Kristen Stewart's performance because it's not bad, but to me it just was. I mean, similarly to Emma Corrin's actually in the Crown, although I think she probably had more of a chance to inhabit it because obviously there's more weight to the Crown, there's longer to go. But this is it did. She just whispered. She just did. She does the kind of very awkward mannered head thing, which I'm sure was Diana some of the time, but it kind of been Diana all the time. She's even doing this when she's with her children, and you know, it's very hard for her to break out from that. I don't agree with Mark in that I felt that the very good English actors in here are woefully underused, and there was a bizarre scene at the end with Sally Hawkins, which I just found myself laughing at, which I don't think I meant to be, but I did. Someone has said that this is meant to have more in common with The Shining than with The Crown, because it's meant to be this haunted house fable of, and I don't know who this film is made for. It kicks off with your classic tragic princess, and I'm gonna say this. I think the misery porn that we have attached to Diana's life a little bit. You know, you have the typical the very first scene, she's throwing up in the toilet. It's this whole thing about being weighed, but then they kind of move away from that to try and show that this is this allegory of her escaping from this horribly fusty establishment. But you never see enough of the royal family to care. In all seriousness, I think if you want to see a piece of art that's going to maybe give you a little bit more of a hint of what it's probably like to spend time with the royals, watch the episode of The Crown where Margaret Thatcher has to go to Balmoral, because to me that was a much more rounded, and even actually the last episode of The Crown, which is the same kind of weekend with Diana desperately unhappy at Sandringham. This, I know critics have liked it. I don't think many people are going to see it. I just don't understand who it's made for. I just don't know who the audience is for this film. And that comes from me, who I really, really liked Jackie. I didn't expect to like Jackie. I'm not a huge fan of Natalie Portman. I'm not a huge fan of Kristen Stewart, but I really, really like Jackie. So I wanted to like this, and I just couldn't. I just couldn't at all. It's awful.
So not a great depiction of anyone there from Emma's point of view. Simon, the film opens with a title card stating a fable based on a true tragedy, clueing the audience in that they're about to see, what they're about to see has had some substantial creative liberty taken. Was this a wise romantic decision, or did it perhaps distance you from the material at all?
No, it's a very good decision. I think one of the problems that Emma's having with it is that it isn't necessarily a full depiction of Diana. It is only set over 3 days, and it's when she is probably at her lowest and not happy and charming as you expect her to be amongst the other times. It is, although it did take me a while for the film to click for me, when it did, it became a really, really effective treatise on angst and depression and the feeling of being trapped, and it did become the almost a horrific overtone and almost a horror movie, which you can see that when you're trying to escape, and whether the, you know, physically and figuratively, the life that she felt when she was trapped, how angst it can be. The soundtrack by Johnny Greenwood, with these are the discordant strings of the like string quartet going into jazz. I mean, I don't like jazz, but what it did here effectively was it set my nerves on edge when they should have been. I think it was absolutely ended up being an amazing study on, like I said, on depression, on anxiety, and mental health. And that's what the film is. It's not a biopic of Diana. It's using her as a frame to cover everything else.
I don't... No, please don't get me wrong. I was not expecting a biopic of Diana. I'm certainly not expecting it now in, you know, an hour and 40 minutes or whatever, or well-read. I get that it's a fable. I get that this is an allegory, but it just... Kristen Stewart didn't... There was no human... It felt like she'd studied her so much that there was no human side coming out of her at all. And you're obviously, I guess, you're meant to be feeling sympathetic for her, for this study of a woman who is in crisis, who is in a mental health crisis. But I didn't get... I felt like I was utterly removed from it, and more crucially for me, it was incredibly dull.
Do we feel the other royals get a fair shake of the stick in this one?
I mean, it portrays the royals as being very distant. You get maybe a couple of scenes with Prince Charles. I think you get one. Yeah, but the Queen maybe gets one line. This is all trying to position Diana as the people's princess, because she's interacting with the people, not with the royals. I think you can make your own conclusions about whether that's a fair judgment or not. I'm going to try and respond to Emma's point about who it's made for. I think it's made for people who aren't British, and maybe we're the wrong audience for it, because what Pablo Larraín has done so effectively across his career, not only in Jackie but also in the films he's made about his homeland in Chile, is to try to understand some of those relationships and those clashes, and to try and see those external perspectives. So I do wonder actually if anyone in this country is the right audience for it. So maybe, you know, it would be interesting to see what people back in his homeland of Chile think of it. But, you know, I think he's trying to understand from the outside. I would also recommend, if people have got the time to go away and do a bit of reading, there's been some fantastic writing online about that perspective that he's brought to films, you know, sort of Chilean perspective, because this was obviously around a kind of British era that follows on from sort of Margaret Thatcher and Pinochet and all those kind of relationships. I think there's an awful lot of subtext here that maybe went completely over my head, so I'm looking more at the surface of it. But I actually do think it's an honest portrayal of a woman in a mental health crisis, and, you know, she's not doing what people in that situation tend to do and putting the brave face on. You're seeing all of that internal struggle as a result of what's done to her by these people that she can barely look in the face.
She's similar to Jackie, of course. I mean, Jackie was a very good portrayal of someone who's suffering massive PTSD, really, after this. But just to give you some context, this cost $20 million to make, and it made $2 million in the States so far. It is not connecting with... It might be connecting in Chile, but I don't think it's connect... I don't know. I mean, I know you saw it, Lorcan. What did you think? I know you're hosting.
I personally found it a bit of a mixed bag. I think it's they certainly took a risk doing it the way they did. I think they put a little too much, almost a little too much from the perspective of Dinah herself. But Pablo Rain's obviously no stranger to the biography format. And Stephen Knight is obviously a fan of writing historical dramas. There's a lot of talent behind the camera with, as Simon mentioned, Johnny Greenwood's score and Claire Mathon's photography. Do we feel that it's overall a bit of style over substance, or does it all blend seamlessly with the story?
I mean, I'll make a comment about the soundtrack, which actually I felt was the bit that didn't work for me. I love Johnny Greenwood's music. Some of his film scores have been brilliant, particularly with Paul Thomas Anderson. Here, I felt it was actually giving us too much of Diana's internal monologue. She walks into a room and Johnny Greenwood's score, all you get these dissonant chords, and it's mental health crisis writ large on the score. And for me, that was too much. I think actually that could have been dialed down a bit. I'm very much looking forward to when people get the chance to see the new Jane Campion film, The Power of the Dog, because he's done the score for that as well. And that, for me, is weirdly a return to form from the score for Spencer. So that was my one real issue with it. I think, actually, it does wear its heart on its sleeve a little too much on occasions. And if we're comparing to Jackie, I do think Jackie's a better film.
Cool. Oh, by about a million miles. Sorry, I thought this was dirge. I really did, and I was really surprised to read all the really good critic reviews. I feel like I've seen a completely different film, and it's not its fault, obviously, that it's coming on the back of The Crown, but The Crown is, at the end of the day, one of the biggest successes of recent years. It's probably Netflix's biggest success, and they have done that, you know, and it's just hard. Can we maybe just leave Diana alone for a little bit?
Well, you can all find out for yourself. Spencer is a certificate 12A, and it's screening at the Arts Picture House, The Light Cinema, and View. Last but not least, we join Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga as they navigate the intolerance and struggles of 1920s New York in Netflix's new release, Passing.
Pardon me, I don't mean to stare, but I think I know you.
Claire?
I'm trying to find out the history of the blonde you've brought along.
She's a girl from Chicago I used to know.
Princess from Chicago.
Things aren't always what they seem.
I'll be damned. Lots of people pass all the time.
It's easy for a Negro to pass for white. I'm not sure it'd be so simple for a white person to pass for color.
So you haven't ever thought to?
What?
You ever thought of passing?
No, why should I? I have everything I've ever wanted.
This is my husband, John Bellew. Does he know?
After mixed-race childhood friends Irene and Claire meet during the Harlem Renaissance, Irene discovers her acquaintance is passing as white and married to a prejudiced, wealthy white man. The encounter stirs up an old obsession that they must both come to terms with. Emma, this is actress Rebecca Hall's first feature film, both as writer and director. Is it more than a mere performance-driven piece?
Yes, it really is. I thought, I didn't know what to expect from this, and I just thought it was a beautifully crafted, beautiful looking film. She shot it in this boxy 3:4 ratio. She's gone for this very classic look, very stationary. She shot the same shot, you see the same sort of shot of the house over and over again, repetitive score as well. I didn't know this until, I didn't know that Passing is a very popular novella that came out in 1929, so it was contemporary at the time, so I imagine it was quite daring, so it's been quite well studied. I wasn't aware of that. I also wasn't aware that Rebecca Hall herself has a black grandfather, I believe, so this is, being a very light-skinned, mixed-race person, this is obviously why this is spoken to and she's taken it on. I just thought it was wonderful. I think the performances of Ruth Negga and Tessa Thompson, she has coaxed performances I wouldn't have expected to have seen out of either of those actresses here. And it's a beautifully small film, but with the weight of something so much bigger around it. And I think that's what I really liked about it.
Yazi, does the traditional presentation do justice to the very nuanced subject matter of the film?
Absolutely. I think Passing is an absolutely stunning film. I think Rebecca Hall has treated it so sensitively. And not just in terms of the subject matter, but the way she filmed it. She takes her time with it. It's very well crafted, as Emma has already alluded to. And I think that it's an absolutely fantastic study of identity. It's something so huge. It's not just racial identity, which is at its core, but actually the intersectionality of what it's like to not only be black, but to be a woman, to be a mother. All of that comes into play here. And I think it's just wonderfully done. I think it's an understated film. I also didn't know what to expect, but I know how much passing was a big thing in the United States, and to take this subject matter and really consider it. As Emma's mentioned, Rebecca Hall has her own history here with the subject matter, but it's just done so sensitively, and I really cared for all the characters. I really cared for their lives, their backgrounds, their families, and I think that's to its credit.
Netflix is a bit of a behemoth when it comes to releases. Do we feel this stands out from the crowd?
Yeah, without, and I hope it doesn't get lost, perhaps, because it's landed on the same day as I think they also launched Red Notice. Very different film, I imagine. But I would really, really ask people to seek this out, because it's just a marvellous piece of work. And there is a sense, like you said, because obviously Ruth Negger is passing, and she's married to, as soon as Alexander Skarsgård, you know he's going to be a terrible human being, and of course he proves thus to be. But Tessa Thompson's life as well, which on the surface, Claire, her friend, because she's lost connections with all of her background and her, you know, she's passing, she wants to be back in Harlem, she wants to be back amongst the people she grew up with. But it turns out that Claire's life is also complicated, and all kinds of shades in here, and it's just done beautifully.
They're both fascinated with each other.
Yeah.
Talk about grass is greener on the other side. They both want something that the other person has, and I think the way that that's portrayed in the film, there's some really interesting filmmaking choices, thinking about, you know, the art of deception that Rebecca Hall does so well, that you are also fascinated with both of them as a result, and you really can understand their motivations as characters. And with this subject matter, that's very hard to do,
and brilliantly done as well, because they never even go into detail about how, you know, because they're old school friends, but you don't really find out much history about their friendship, but yet you feel you can read it just within the nuances. It really was fabulous.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, thank you for that. Sounds like it's a worthwhile online streaming watch for anyone who's at a loss for the weekend. Passing is a certificate 12A, and it's available now on Netflix. Thank you for joining us this week. We'll be back in 2 weeks, when releases will include Ghostbusters Afterlife, Petit Maman, and House of Gucci. For everyone from here, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.